This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is on assignment. Coming up, a defender of the Bill of Rights fights NSA spying to a hip-hop beat. Massachusetts lawmakers vote to give workers the highest state minimum wage in the country. And a drive to keep Uganda's foreign minister from presiding over the United Nations General Assembly. But first, when Temple University fired African American Studies professor Anthony Monteiro, the administration didn't anticipate that it would set off a firestorm of protest in Philadelphia. Students, community organizations, and organized labor have come together in a movement that goes way beyond the demands for the professor's reinstatement. Dr. Monteiro says the opposition to Temple has evolved into a broad, united front.
It started back in January, the current phase of the struggle, with my termination and firing. And over the last 5 or 6 months, what has developed is a social movement that includes everyone from students, a brilliant and vast student coalition, to a grassroots movement of people of all persuasions, religiously, ideologically, and politically, to the labor movement, and even including major Black elected officials here in the city of Philadelphia. It is one of those movements that is so broad and so deep that we've often dreamt of them, that this is the type of movement that we said and we believed if we could get going would make a difference in the lives of ordinary African Americans and of ordinary people, period. And that's what we have put together here. It is centered upon many of the injustices that are associated with Temple University, not least of them being gentrification, the fact that students who are paying more and more in tuitions have less and less to say about their education, and of course, the treatment of people like myself, those who are non-tenured faculty, who are treated like people without even citizenship rights or due process rights, and the treatment of the workforce at a large corporate university like Temple is, period. A good part of the workforce who are unionized without a contract at this point. So this movement is a broad movement. It is a movement of substance. It is a movement addressing the problems created by neoliberal capitalism at this stage of its development.
Well, let's talk about some of the components of this movement. How deeply embedded is it in labor in Philadelphia, in community struggle in Philadelphia, and among the students at Temple University?
Well, it's very, very deep and growing. For example, it is well known that 1199C of the Hospital Workers Union and its leader, Henry Nicholas, have supported me very, very strongly. It might not be as well known that the leadership of Laborers District Council 332 are also supporting me. And now the leadership of the largest union in the city, AFSCME, District Council 33, is supporting me. So in terms of labor, a significant part of organized labor in the city, and I'm certain that as we go forward, more of them will come into this movement. We just haven't had the opportunity to reach out to as many people as we would like to, but certainly the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers will join us. But past leaders of, for example, of the International Longshoremen's Association the local here in Philadelphia. It's passed Vice President, the past president of AFSCME District Council 47 is on board with us, and there is some indication that leaders of the Railroad Workers Union are coming into the fold. In terms of the grassroots black community, the big question of gentrification and poverty is central. And as you know, we have connected the struggle for my reinstatement to the fight against this form of gentrification that Temple is carrying out in North Central Philadelphia. And coincidentally, probably spurred on by what we're doing, there are now meetings all over North Philadelphia on gentrification. Gentrification will be, I am certain, an issue in next year's mayoral race. It's a big, big question, and I think we have helped to spur that on. In terms of the student movement at Temple, I like to say that what we are seeing are the children of the Occupy movement and the children of the Trayvon movement are coming together. It is radical, but it is also mainstream. It is not far left or sectarian. It is a genuine student movement, mainstream, right in the core of the concerns of students. And for this reason, 2,000 students at Temple, primarily in the College of Liberal Arts, have signed a petition for my reinstatement. And I guess the final thing is that some of the most powerful elected officials in the city of Philadelphia have signed on to this movement and are active in demanding that the Temple administration reinstate me.
And why has your predicament had such a cathartic effect on all these different sectors?
You know, Glenn, I am in many ways a native son of Philadelphia, of North Philadelphia. My family has been in North Philadelphia for decades, and I have been a part of many of the movements of social and political change over the decades here in Philadelphia. So, although I'm not like a celebrity, I am known among ordinary Philadelphians. And in a sense, people viewed an injustice to me as something unacceptable, especially since many people are aware that I did not and have not used my position as a professor at Temple as a way to separate myself from the community. In fact, I've always felt that the university should be open as a public institution to the public, especially its neighbors in the poor and working class communities that surround Temple. But then again, the issues are so pertinent to the day-to-day lives of people. And that's what we were able to do, to connect something that may be a bit remote, a university professor losing his job, to connect that to what are the life, world experiences and crises of ordinary people. And so I think that's kind of what has made it such an important part of the social and political life of Black Philadelphia at this time.
You and others have described this movement as a kind of united front, but a united front not just for the sake of unity, but united around principles.
That's right. And it is a united front. It is a principled united front. It is a united front where people are part of it not because they seek to be transformed ideologically or religiously or politically, but they are part of it because this movement, this coalition, this united front is fighting for what most people believe to be justice. against a powerful institution, which is not a great institution because it has abandoned its responsibility of service to the public. Black Philadelphia in particular understands that Temple University not only is gentrifying the community, but is hyper-policing the community, is creating a gated, sanitized area of primarily whiteness, and it keeps the vast majority of Black North Philadelphia away from the gates, polices them, and this island of privilege in a sea of poverty is so obvious to everyone that I think all that was necessary is for someone to stand up and say, this is what it is, and this is what we must do to change the situation. This powerful institution must be answerable to somebody. And what we're saying is it has to be answerable to the people.
And this island of privilege, as you describe it, is not just hermetically sealed against the community, but is constantly expanding into the community and driving up rents and influencing the whole character of the surrounding area.
Absolutely. And you know, the thing that is so very interesting is that not only is the community standing up against this, but there are students who are saying we don't want to have to pay higher and higher tuitions and have fewer and fewer services while the university uses our tuition money to buy up land throughout North Central Philadelphia. So there is an anti-gentrification sentiment even among the students of Temple University.
Do you think the university may have bitten off more than it can chew in terminating Tony Montero and setting off this firestorm?
Possibly. Certainly in terminating me, they set off a firestorm. It is on our shoulders to develop the fight back in such a way that we can win. And we can win on this one. And I don't mean in the sometime distant future. I mean, we can win this one now. And that's what we're aiming for. It was overreach. It's been overreaching for some time. But it seems that they may have bit off more than they can chew. I would say this, however, that perhaps they were advised poorly by people who thought they knew me and thought they knew Black Philadelphia.
You may be talking about Molefi Asante, now head of a department that he calls the Department of Africology, who played a major role in instigating your termination.
Yes. I would put him as the central figure in this respect. Yes, he underestimated ordinary people. He underestimated Black Philadelphia. He overestimated his influence in the African-American community. And he really underestimated the fact that I would not walk away from injustice, that I would stand up to it. That's my history. That's my moral core.
And now Dr. Asante, who calls himself an Afrocentrist, is defending the perks and privileges of this very university, this center of corporate power in Black Philadelphia.
Yes, and not only that, but in so defending the university and its quote-unquote right to aggress upon ordinary people, upon the Black working class, what he is actually defending is his own class privileges. And I think this is a difficult thing for many African Americans to address forthrightly. A new cut of class division, class segmentation within the African American community, and the appearance of a type of disconnected elite, disconnected from black people, but intimately connected to the centers of white power. And even as they are disconnected from black people, they try and they claim to speak for black people. And that's why you have this problem of a kind of an African identity as a cover and a mode of obscuring a class interest that is different from that of the majority of the African-American people, especially at this time of economic crisis, the rise of poverty and mass incarceration, of homelessness and hunger, of the collapse of public education. To speak in generalities about Africa and African people without putting anything on the line in the struggle for African people is the height of hypocrisy.
Your last paycheck is due to arrive at the end of this month, and we are now in the summer. What does all this mean in terms of the growth of this united front?
Well, whether it will be my last paycheck or not, whether Temple's upper administration and the Board of Trustees will overturn Dean Soufis's and Dr. Asante's firing of me, this movement will not end. The students are already preparing for the fall and planning. The community remains steadfast in the fight against gentrification. And in this, it is not just the grassroots, it is the institutions of Black Philadelphia, the churches, the political organizations, elected officials, and so on, who are also standing up and questioning gentrification and rising property taxes and impoverishment of the community and the displacement of Black people. So that will continue. The fight for the right of professors and workers at Temple will continue. Henry Nicholas just yesterday reminded me that the workers that he represents at Temple don't have a contract, and nobody from the administration has yet spoken to him about this matter. And so they intend to keep fighting. The non-tenured and non-tenure-track faculty, the adjuncts, will continue to fight. The students will continue to raise the issue of their voices being heard. So this movement is not going away anytime soon. It will just become stronger. I would suggest that Temple begin to think about ways to move back from the brink of disaster, to find some way of talking in reasonable terms to the people, its neighbors in North Philadelphia, to the students. That's the only way out. But struggle will continue. We're at a period in the history of this country where the masses of people have very few options except the struggle.
Dr. Anthony Montiero in Philadelphia.
The NSA breaks the law every day. It doesn't matter who you are or what you say. They monitor your phone calls and emails anyway. Corrupt Congress, of course, paving the way. There's a lesson you'll learn someday. Watch what you say. See, they spy on your mind, record your calls for fidelity, commit daily executive crimes with impunity. They're the authorities here to keep us safe until the beat ends up on your face. The Constitution, we the people of the world, the government is abusing. We can force any agency to make a new choice when we build a movement, each raising our voice.
The voice you just heard is Shahid Buttar, and the song is The NSA versus the USA. Buttar is executive director of the Washington-based Bill of Rights Defense Committee, which has been in the forefront of the fight against the NSA's massive spying on the American people. Buttar is a constitutional lawyer by day and a practitioner of hip-hop every chance he gets. He says it's a good mix.
Well, I've been a musician longer than I was a lawyer, right? I mean, I came up rhyming in Chicago in the 90s, when I first got exposed to house music, so I've sort of been like a house head who rhymes, sort of in this weird gap between hip-hop and house music before I ever, you know, I didn't get to law school until the 2000 to 2003 specifically. So it's really a matter of, in some respects, of returning to my roots, as it were, but particularly trying to bring to the microphone not just political consciousness that I think I've always tried to embody as an artist, but quite frankly, in this song, the specificity and precision that I learned as a lawyer, it's basically a hip-hop history lesson set to house music. That's what the song is. And there's a web page where I annotated all the lyrics. So for somebody who's particularly engaged by, for instance, the FBI's plot to neutralize Dr. King, and that's the FBI's word, which I make very conspicuous in the video, you know, there are links to articles and reports and background information to learn more. It's a public education tool that tries to use the dance floor and party culture as a venue in which to extend the popular education of the primary education system, the mass media, that so many channels through which people used to get information, through which those are, you know, failing.
So you're trying to politically and historically inform the popular culture. What uses has your video, NSA versus USA, been put to your knowledge?
Well, it has been screened at least at a couple of the events on Reset the Net Day. That was the anniversary of the Snowden leaks when several internet companies announced that they were going to be encrypting their data flows within their networks. And on that same day, there were events in San Francisco and Charlotte, North Carolina, and here where I live in Washington, D.C., and the video is screened in each of those places. So it's been used as a vehicle to bring people together, and I hope very much that it's a vehicle to teach people about the issues. And it's been viewed about 3,000 times on YouTube in the 2 weeks since it was released, and I hope very much the more people come to see it. I would say that in terms of not the video, but thinking back on the history of politicized music, you know, because your question before was sort of striking at this interplay between politics and culture. There is a long tradition of political consciousness in music going back to the very beginnings of music, right? I mean, the griot spoken word oral history tradition is where music came from. It's where politics came from. I mean, they're sort of embedded. They came from the same root. And I think of them as basically somewhat different sensibilities, logoses or logi perhaps, as striking at the same ethos. As a lawyer MC, I don't actually see a particular distinction between those identities. They're different vernaculars, you know, but other than that, it's just different hammers to hit the same nail, perhaps. And I think there's a long-standing tradition in the not very distant past either. You know, you think about John Lennon, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan, you know, into the whole jazz era. There's back in the blues as an expression of a socio-political consciousness of a people. And I think that's a tradition in which I think every artist should stand, and I'm honored to be a part of it.
And are you considering this becoming part of your regular production along with your political and legal writings?
You know, I really hope so. The song is kind of a product of some soul searching from 2013 and dealing with just personal burnout issues and, you know, struggling for inspiration myself and realizing that I'm really only using half my brain and getting, this is sort of like getting back to my roots. You know, aside from, I think, representing a product of which I'm very proud and a collaboration among, you know, a dozen or more excellent artists who I've been proud to work with, the song for me has really been a connection to my essential self, and I hope not to lose that. It was enabled by a Kickstarter campaign this spring, and, you know, I don't know to what extent I'm going to do another one of those next week, but I do think to the extent I can more regularly put this stuff together, I certainly hope to. Nothing would make me happier.
Well, I want to pull you back into the arena of your day job just for a second. The NSA, the National Security Agency, which purports to be the all-seeing eyes and all-hearing ears of the United States, how could the NSA not have known that ISIS, the jihadist group, which U.S. funding has been so much a part of the growth of, was not about to launch a major offensive or be the spearhead of a major offensive in Iraq?
The CIA has a long history of being on both sides of conflicts and instigating conflicts that we then later sacrifice a great deal to address. And there's any number of places we could demonstrate this, from Afghanistan, where they trained the precursors of Al-Qaeda, to Saddam Hussein, which the CIA, you know, supplied his regime for years, Iran, which the CIA supplied. That's what the Iran-Contra scandal was about, was the CIA basically trading weapons with our nation's central enemy. And the idea that they're under the table, betraying American interests, taking tax dollars to do it, destabilizing our international relations. The short answer to why they hate us, to the extent anyone hates us, is the CIA. Three letters. It's not that long. And I think it's very unfortunate to see in ISIS the sort of recreation of this pattern of the CIA's complicity with people who have been our enemies, will be our enemies, are allied with people who are currently our enemies. And it sort of reminds me of a parable I remember when I lived in Chicago back in the 90s. You know, there was this idea that the street crews, which the city was paying under the Daley administration, would basically pave the road so that they could tear it up to give them an excuse to submit a contract to repave it again. That's kind of what the CIA has been doing ever since it was created.
Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee in Washington. The Massachusetts state legislature has passed the highest minimum wage in the country, and the governor is expected to sign the measure into law. The minimum wage would rise from $8 to $11 an hour over 3 years. The Massachusetts Community Action Network fought hard to raise the minimum. Executive Director Lou Finfer says even in the most liberal state in the nation, raising wages is hard work.
Well, it didn't really sail through the legislature, but the reason it passed primarily is that there was a great coalition formed last year called the Raise Up Massachusetts Coalition of over 100 community groups, labor unions, and faith-based organizations. We ended up collecting over 200,000 signatures to qualify raising the minimum wage to be on the ballot this fall. And because we had qualified for this, the legislative leadership in our state felt they had to take it up and were willing to take it up at that point. Had we not gotten the signatures, they either wouldn't have passed the bill or would have passed a much less of a minimum wage increase. So that was the key thing. It's all the hard work that about 6,000 or 7,000 volunteers did. We had 63 days last fall where we had to collect the first round of signatures, and then 32 days during May and June where we had to collect the second round of signatures. So people collected in churches, in front of supermarkets, at sports leagues. People were everywhere collecting those signatures and to qualify for the ballot. And that was the leverage that led our legislative leadership to decide to take this up and pass this at this good increase rate, which would be the highest in the country of state laws, highest in the country, going from $8 to $11 over the next 3 years.
So the ballot initiative was a threat.
Yes, it was a threat in that sense, or a leverage to get them to deal with it. If we had just gone the legislative route, which we had tried the last time we worked on this in 2006, the amount of increase was smaller, and there was no increase for what are called tip workers. So by taking this route to the ballot, we were able to show the legislative leadership that we had another route to go, and it could be placed before the people, but they were willing to then take this up and pass a good bill. And so that's to the better, and it'll go into effect January 1st.
And in dollar terms, how much is this worth to low-wage earners?
This is huge. It's over 600,000 low-wage earners in our state will benefit from this, and an estimated $1.1 billion in increased wages will come to them, and also help our local economy, because low-wage earners are going to have to spend and will spend most of that back in our local economy. So it's a really big thing. We also took on, parallel to the minimum wage, another proposal around dignity and values at work called earned sick days. 30% of people in our state no longer get any earned sick days to take care of themselves or their children or elderly parents and their jobs. So we also collected signatures to qualify that for the ballot, and we will be filing those signatures in the next 10 days, and that will be on the ballot this fall in our state.
And what is the effect on workers who make much of their earnings from tips?
The tip worker increase wasn't as big as we had hoped for, but they will get the first increase, at least in our state, they've gotten since 1997. The tip workers make, you know, Massachusetts make $2.63 an hour plus their tips, and they will go up to over 3 years to $3.75 an hour plus tips. When the tips don't give them enough to reach the minimum wage, the employer is supposed to fill that gap so they at least get to the minimum wage. But the restaurant workers feel that that is not always enforced, and it needs better enforcement.
And did you have any models for this campaign?
I think the model, you know, Massachusetts is also known for the first passage of the Health Care for All to provide health insurance in 2005. And that was one of the learnings. A number of us were involved in that campaign. And even though it's remembered as a legislative law that was passed by a Democratic legislature and signed by then Governor Romney, again, the leverage to move the legislation was that the coalition working on that back in 2005 collected enough signatures to go to the ballot, and that proved to be leverage to move the legislature to pass something. So that was a model we learned from. And then we also learned from past years where we only tried legislatively and then were left at the end of the day for the legislative leadership to be able to make the decision, you know, without listening to us enough.
Are you sufficiently satisfied with this minimum wage increase to leave the issue alone for the next 3 years?
I don't think we'd say leave the issue alone. It is the highest state minimum wage law in the country, so we think it's a big victory and a big accomplishment. But we are looking at other wage issues that we want to bring up next year related to funding for job training, possibility of what's called a living wage law at the state level covering companies that get state subsidies and loans, wage theft laws. So we are going to be looking at other job-related legislation that we can work on that'll enable people to have better working conditions, better wages in the future. But then we haven't made a decision, but there are already people in our coalition are talking about in 2017 trying to go back to the legislature and ask them to raise the wages again, because $11 an hour, it will be worth less then than it is worth now because of inflation. And our real goal is obviously to get more people to what are called living wage jobs, which would probably be at the rate of between $15 and $17 an hour. But to go from 8 to 11 is really a big step, and we know it's going to help a lot of people here, and we hope it'll help the debate in other states. Because whenever it goes higher, it can embolden community groups, faith-based groups, civil rights groups, and legislators to try to do more than they might have thought it was possible. The same way we've been inspired by the fast food workers organizing, and that the city of Seattle passed a $15 minimum wage law.
So what kind of political chemistry do you think you brought to this strategy?
I started in the civil rights movement. And this coalition that we worked on, you know, some years later was the broadest I've ever seen in terms of having equal numbers of community groups, faith-based groups. We're a faith-based group in Massachusetts and also part of the PICO National Network across the country. And labor unions work together. And equally, each of those three sectors, community, labor, and faith, collected one-third of the signatures each. So it was a very broad coalition, and most coalitions are only one of those sectors or dominated by one of those sectors. So I think that worked to our advantage, and people are talking about continuing the coalition into next year and future years, because there's many other issues around racial justice with the prison pipeline to prison issues, immigrant rights, other job issues that we want to tackle.
That was Lou Finfer of the Massachusetts Community Action Network. Change.org is circulating a petition that calls on Secretary of State John Kerry to revoke the visa of Ugandan Foreign Minister Sam Kutesa so that he won't be able to take his seat as President of the United Nations General Assembly. Kutesa was elected to preside over the world body for the session that begins in September. But opponents say he should be blocked because of his own corruption and the crimes of the Ugandan government, which is complicit in the genocide in Congo. Milton Alamadi is publisher of Black Star News in New York and a native of Uganda.
Sam Kutesa is very close to the Ugandan dictator General Yoweri Museveni. He's been his foreign affairs minister since 2005. But he's had several ministerial positions in the Ugandan regime since Museveni came to power in 1986. In Uganda, he is very notorious for one thing, corruption. He's known to be corrupt. In addition to being censured by Uganda's parliament, there have been several corruption allegations against him. And let me give you a few examples. In 1999, he was censured by Uganda's parliament. These were lawmakers from his own ruling party, the National Resistance Movement Party. They looked at the evidence, and it was so compelling, they had to censor him. They found that while at the time he was junior minister of finance, he also had a private company called Entebbe Handling Services. And the company handles cargo as well as luggage at airports. Has the exclusive contract for Entebbe Airport in Uganda. But what he did was he formed a partnership with Uganda Airlines, the country's only national airlines. But then he used that 50-50 partnership to divert all the resources of the airline to his own private company, Entebbe Handling Services. And then he forced the airline to sell itself to his private company at a basement rate so that he amassed millions of dollars in profit through that procedure. When the general manager of Uganda Airlines protested numerous times, Kutesa threatened his life. Kutesa stole the resources of the airline together in partnership with General Salim Saleh, who is the younger brother of General Museveni. So he was censored for that in parliament. That's number one. Number two, when Uganda hosted the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in 2007, when all these former British colonies, they're in a partnership called the Commonwealth of Nations, they came and they attended. It was this grand conference with gala. The Queen of England herself came. It turns out that at least by one estimate, $150 million, or part of the money allocated for this conference, was stolen by ministers, including Sam Kutesa, allegedly. It was so egregious that the British government considered barring him from the UK, restricting his visa. And how do we know this? Because the United States ambassador to Uganda, Mr. Jerry Lanier, wrote a confidential memo dated January 13, 2010, to the State Department and to the CIA. That memo was subsequently leaked by WikiLeaks. And that memo suggested that the British wanted the U.S. support because the British were considering the visa restriction on Sam Kutesa. The British said they were looking at several ministers for that corruption, but they were focusing most of their attention on Sam Kutesa. And the U.S. Ambassador Lanier, in his own observation, said, "We consider Kutesa's corruption to be egregious." So Sam Kutesa is well known to the U.S. administration. And then thirdly, a member of parliament in Uganda produced documents in parliament, which he said showed that Sam Kutesa had accepted millions of dollars in bribes from a foreign oil company that was interested in concessions in Uganda. Now, Sam Kutesa has never been tried on the alleged acceptance of millions of dollars in bribes and the alleged diversion of money that was allocated to host the Commonwealth Conference. And why is that? Because he has a very close relationship to General Museveni, and his daughter is married to the son of General Museveni. His name is Brigadier Muhoozi Kainerugaba. He commands a special force, which many people believe is actually much more powerful than the National Army itself. And his main task is to protect his father, General Museveni, as well as Uganda's oil fields. So for that reason, Kutesa will never be tried in Uganda. Now, let's look at the behavior of Uganda, and let's see how this can conform with somebody who's associated today with the United Nations as president of the General Assembly. Uganda was found liable in 2005 by the International Court of Justice for war crimes in the Congo, invading Congo, massacring civilians, mass rapes were committed, plundering resources of the Congo, and occupying Congo's territory until almost 2005. The court ruled in favor of the Congo and ordered Uganda to pay $6 to $10 billion. Not a dime of that money has been paid. And the International Criminal Court opened its own separate investigation. And the Wall Street Journal wrote an article about this and reported on June 8, 2006, that General Museveni himself contacted then Secretary General Kofi Annan and urged him to block that investigation. And supposedly Kofi Annan told him that he did not have that power. But clearly somebody has blocked that investigation, because using the same set of facts for which the International Court of Justice found Uganda liable, the ICC would have found Museveni and the military command that was responsible for the atrocities in the Congo, would have indicted them and possibly found them guilty. And Sam Kutesa, as a senior minister, could possibly be one of those individuals who might have been indicted for the crimes committed by Uganda.
Well, clearly, as Sam Kutesa is given impunity by the president, Museveni, Uganda and Museveni himself are given impunity for their crimes against Congo and elsewhere by the United States.
Yes, Kutesa will never be tried in Uganda. He has blanket immunity from the president. And why does General Museveni have immunity? He has immunity because Museveni has made a bargain with the U.S. administration. And that bargain is to supply Ugandan troops to, quote-unquote, stabilize Somalia. Uganda has anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 troops in Somalia, which the U.S. says would fall to Al-Qaeda-affiliated militia, which is Al-Shabaab, were it not for the outside intervention. So therefore, Museveni gets a blank check because of that. And that is how Sam Kutesa was not opposed by the administration, despite the fact that all his transgressions and corruption is well known, as indicated by the memo from the U.S. ambassador himself. Now let's look at Uganda's behavior in Somalia. There have been several reports that Ugandan soldiers have actually been selling weapons to Al-Shabaab. And Uganda has a good motive for that as well. Because without Al-Shabaab and without any conflict in Somalia, Uganda would not have this exceptionalism, having this exceptionalism relationship with the United States, where it gets away with war crimes in the Congo and political repression within Uganda itself. Let's look at one other element. The United Nations organization is supposed to promote and protect the human rights of all human beings around the world, regardless of their ethnicity, their national origin, their race, their gender, their political affiliation, and their sexual orientation. Uganda in February signed a law which penalizes, one of the penalties is life in prison for people in same-sex relations. And people who know of people that are in same-sex relations, people that know of LGBT community and do not report them to the police or to the authorities, also face prison sentence of 7 years. This means you could be an employer, you could be a landlord, and you discover that somebody is gay. If you don't report them to the police or the authorities, you yourself are subjected to prison time. Now, given this set of facts and knowledge, how is it still possible that an individual like Sam Kutesa can become the president of the United Nations General Assembly?
So you're saying that elevating Sam Kutesa to the presidency of the UN General Assembly would be a blemish on the world body itself?
It is beyond a blemish on the world body itself. It drags it in the mud, and it makes it complicit in corruption, in war crimes, by ignoring the fact that the International Court of Justice came up with a judgment in favor of the Congo and actually awarded damages from $6 to $10 billion, knowing that that money has not yet been paid, that case has not yet been resolved, meaning that is an active case, and then having one of the possible suspects in the war crimes committed against the Congo to become associated with the UN in such a senior capacity, it is beyond the pale. It is corruption at its ultimate. There's one other point that the UN is going to have a difficult time ignoring. That same company for which Kutesa was censured for in Parliament in 1999 has contracts with the United Nations. This is perverted corruption. And what are these contracts for? The contract is to handle cargo and luggage on behalf of UN peacekeeping forces that are in the Congo and in South Sudan. So Uganda is benefiting from blood money. Kutesa's company is making possibly millions of dollars for a war that itself launched against the Congo. Uganda launched a war of aggression against the Congo. That is the reason why the UN sent peacekeepers to the Congo. Kutesa's private company is providing services to these peacekeepers and getting paid for it in the Congo and in South Sudan, where Uganda is also engaged in a war. Uganda, instead of helping to mediate peace between President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar, has sided with Salva Kiir fighting against Riek Machar. And people were wondering, why is Uganda eager to be involved in war rather than resolving the war in South Sudan? Now we know that Sam Kutesa's personal company and Tibet Handling Services is actually handling services at Juba Airport in South Sudan. So Kutesa actually has a motive, a financial motive, to continue that war and, in fact, to escalate that war, not only in South Sudan, but in the Congo, because the war benefits his bottom line. So Kutesa and Tibet Handling Services could be seen as East and Central Africa's version of Halliburton, profiting from blood money, profiting from the blood of millions of Africans in the Congo and in South Sudan. It does not get more outrageous than that.
And you're asking that U.S. Secretary of State Kerry deny a visa to Kutesa so that he can't come to this country and assume the presidency at the U.N. General Assembly.
Absolutely. We asked for that. That has not happened. He was formally elected by acclamation on June 11 because he was the only candidate. But these set of facts that I've outlined have been coming out. The one good thing that our campaign on change.org did was force so-called mainstream media to actually write about the story. So as we speak, more than 50 media outlets have now been writing for the first time about Sam Kutesa's corruption and about Uganda's repressive political environment domestically and about the war of aggression against the Democratic Republic of the Congo. That's the one good thing that has come out of it. And we hope people do go to the Change.org campaign and put up Sam Kutesa's name, Kutesa, on the search engine and find that petition and sign that petition, because what we're trying to do is to get enough signatures to force his resignation. And the UN itself is now on trial. Will they allow an individual who has at least conflict of interest in terms of Tibet Handling Services, if not fraud, if those contracts were obtained fraudulently, disclosing the true ownership, then the UN itself is on trial.
If Sam Kutesa was the only candidate, that would indicate he was the consensus of the African Union of Africa.
And that's a very interesting thing, and I'm glad you asked that question. There were actually two candidates. The other candidate was the Foreign Affairs Minister of Cameroon, Mr. Moukoko. At some point, he withdrew his candidacy, and that's how Sam Kutesa ended up being the only candidate. And we're still trying to ascertain what happened so that Mr. Moukoko, the Foreign Affairs Minister of Cameroon, withdrew to allow Sam Kutesa to have the field unknown. So it wasn't as if the African Union went around the continent and said, of all the individuals that we can nominate, Sam Kutesa is the best candidate we can find. When in fact, he diminishes the legacy and the names of other Africans who have served as presidents of the UN General Assembly, and he should resign.
Milton Alamadi, publisher of Black Star News in New York. Despite the U.S.-backed war that is ravaging his country, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad handily won election earlier this month. Paul Larudi, a San Francisco Bay Area college professor and organizer with the Palestine Solidarity Network, was in Syria as part of a team of international observers. He spoke at a press conference near the United Nations headquarters.
Some of you will remember, maybe better than me, that the former consul general of Israel to New York, I think only a year ago, was visiting here, and he was asked by one of the Zionist publications what he thought would be the best outcome in Syria as far as Israel is concerned. He said, the best outcome, as far as Israel is concerned, is no outcome. No outcome. Now, that is honesty, because Israel, and this is quite reflective of the United States, and that's not an accident that Israel and the United States coincide in their view, it's eternal conflict and death and destruction. This is the future for Syria and Iraq and Libya and all of these. Let's be honest about it. This is what the purpose is. In order to create weakness among groups that are considered allies, and to show nations of the world that if they do not do exactly what the United States and NATO says, there will be hell to pay. This is what it's about. What is Syria's sin? Syria has no foreign debt. It doesn't permit other companies to come in there and own half of the country and to export its wealth. And this is the problem with Syria. This is why Syria has to be destroyed. And yet, the American people don't feel this way. The American people are ashamed of causing death and destruction, if they even understand that it is our government that is causing this. This is terrible. So I want to thank the Syrian people for showing us in this election, which we went to as observers, and we have to come out with an observation. And our observation is that the Syrian people who traveled from across the world, when we were in Syria, we met people from the United States and from many other countries who traveled there in order to vote. Who does this? And they voted in massive numbers in foreign countries when they could, when they were not prevented from doing it. Who is going to do this? And yet the outcome was certain. We knew what the outcome was going to be. We knew who was going to. Why do they do this? Well, I'll tell you why. Because they were sending a message. And what is an election if it is not sending a message to the entire world and to their leadership about who they want? And they did. They did in massive numbers. Compare that, for example, with the election in Egypt, where 92% of the people voted for El-Sisi. Well, 92% of what people? You know, how many people showed up? And there were at least twice as many who showed up in the Syrian election as in the Egyptian election. That is the difference. That is the difference. Because what the Syrian people wanted was very clear, and that is the purpose of an election, and that's what we saw. Joe and I were together in Homs, and we saw the same things that everyone else has reported, just jubilant celebration. It was a way people said as much outside the polling booth as they did inside the polling booth. And it was magnificent. And who are the Syrian people? What about the occupied areas of Syria where no one could vote? Well, those people voted with their feet. They left those occupied areas. 6 million of them are living in government-controlled areas of Syria because they prefer that to living under the regime of terrorists, basically. So they voted. And they voted a second time by casting their ballot in those government areas. And furthermore, they voted not to become refugees outside Syria because twice as many of them are displaced persons within Syria as they are outside Syria. Twice as many preferred to live in Syria under government control rather than to go to Lebanon or to Turkey or anywhere else. That's impressive. One little story I'll tell you about Homs. I happened to go back after the election. And I happened to be in a meeting where municipal leaders and leaders of the Christian community were discussing the reconstruction of the old city of Homs. And they had everything down to the last stone and the last owner of every single place and how it was going to be constructed and who was going to do the work and which foundations were going to provide the funding. This is less than a month after it was liberated. So what I saw there was a people that were determined for their will to be imposed upon the future of Syria, not only in the terms of their president, but in rebuilding wherever it was possible to rebuild in the retaken areas. I don't think these people are going to lose this war. I don't think so. They're absolutely determined.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.